Hello, John Jenkins. I am Paul Henshaw, and I am speaking to you from my home in Sun City, Arizona, where I live with my wife, Christine. It is Friday, 11 May, 1984, and I shall now respond to your letter of 4 May requesting that I prepare a tape indicating how the University of Wisconsin Department of Zoology and School of Medicine affected and influenced my life. Your study of the Department of Zoology, I feel, is an important one, and I am pleased to participate. I have examined your guide material quite carefully in an effort to perceive your specific goals. Since you have chosen to use the tape interview method and the kind of subject matter outlined or requested, I sense that you would like my responses to be somewhat personal as well as historical. Accordingly, I shall follow your outline fairly closely, filling in with a certain determining features, both positive and negative, and indicate my views about how the Department of Zoology affected and molded me. I have had some substantial successes publishing scientific papers and a number of books, and I have been involved in a number of events I regard as noteworthy. During this past year, I may say, I have been instrumental in starting an organization identified as the Institute of Human Experience, a feature of which is to create a videotape library of interviews with noteworthy people. Now, I am in effect to interview myself. This should be good fun. To begin, you have asked where and when I was born. I was born in Oklahoma, August the 23rd, 1902. In the country, on a farm, a quarter section of land which my father homesteaded when the Cherokee Strip was opened in 1893. He rode a sorrel pony in and staked this land and broke the sod and built a home. Around the period 1900, he and my mother lived in a sod house and managed to get into a one-room frame house just in time for my arrival, and I was delivered by a local midwife, a lady who lived on the quarter section just beyond us. As things worked out, I had two brothers, one 4 years younger and the other 6 years younger. I was named Paul. The next, my first brother was Luther, and the third boy had a middle name of Wesley. These names in themselves indicate some of my mother's ambitions for her sons, inasmuch as they're all Methodist Christian names. As time went along also, my father had ideas about his sons, and he felt that he would discharge his obligation to the family if some way or another he could leave a quarter of section of land to each of the boys. Going farther, as time went along, Mother managed to get the three boys of us in school in Winfield, Kansas. That's where I went to high school. And among other things, I was involved with, being a ham radio operator and so on. I learned to build radio receiving sets by winding coils on segments of oatmeal cartons, cans, cylinders, and one evening I remember so very distinctly having a series of these things strung together and held by a vise in my workshop in the basement of the house where we lived, and for the first time I heard music or voice over the air, and it was a remarkable thrill, and the more so, believe it or not, because they were playing On Wisconsin, a very stirring piece in itself. At that stage, of course, Wisconsin, to me, was just another place on the map. In the development of things at that stage, I was following pretty closely the religious concept of my mother and attempting to participate in the ways of the people of the Bible Belt area. But in the high school period, I began to have feelings, guilty feelings actually, because I was professing Christianity and beliefs by means of prayer and participation, but they were not working for me, and I felt very uncomfortable about it. Soon thereafter, I got into Southwestern College, also in Winfield, Kansas. This was a Methodist denominational school, and among other things, I took courses in biology. The professor in charge was a stimulating person, and he had a good reputation of stimulating students to enter graduate work. One of the things that happened during that period was that I read a book entitled Being Well Born by Michael F. Geyer, Chairman of the Department of Zoology, University of Wisconsin. It was a eugenic story, a eugenic book, of course, and I was much stimulated by it. And shortly thereafter, we were asked to write a thesis, that is, in the class that I was attending, and I chose a topic, not being well born, but the rights of the unborn, which gave me a chance to be a little imaginative and plead the case of a person, let us say, with a prospective life. The professor, and his name was William Goldsmith, liked what I had done, and I was proud of the piece. Among other things, I showed it to my mother, whereupon she got the impression that evolution was being taught in the college, and she accepted the task of bringing the college down, which she almost did. And I was drawn into a controversy that was rather significant. 50 years later, that is 1975, when I attended my 50th anniversary year at Southwestern College. Among other things, they were talking about the Southwestern College monkey trial and my part in it. And one of the faculty members interviewing me at the time moved in to write a play, which was rather delicately done, It was called Kindred Minds. There are three characters. My mother, Paul as a student, and the third character was Paul 50 years later. And the conversation took place between these three, and it portrayed rather beautifully, I think, the kind of issue that arose so commonly in the families in that early period that I knew in Oklahoma and Kansas. In my last year of college, as was customary in the small colleges at that time, I applied for assistantship in departments of biology or zoology in a number of universities, and got a positive response from the University of Wisconsin. And that is the thing that took me to Wisconsin. Going from a small denominational school in Kansas to a large university, the University of Wisconsin, was an enormous step for me. I entered the university, became an office mate with Stillman Wright, and as an assistant, soon had responsibilities not only of aiding in laboratory work, but in promoting quiz sections as well. This meant standing before freshman students and, acting as an instructor, guiding the students in their thinking and answering questions as was necessary. A thing that I must indicate here is that at Southwestern College under Professor Goldsmith, with his enthusiasm for eugenics and other things, including his participation in the Scopes trial in Tennessee, we were not on biology, dissecting frogs and cats and this kind of thing, but in proofreading a book of his and so on, so that I came to the University of Wisconsin not well prepared in biology, so that my participation as a graduate assistant meant a careful, rigorous study daily, just attempting to keep ahead of the classes. This went along reasonably well for a period. It was customary in those days to promote, to have graduate seminars, and it in which the graduate students participated. The one that particular year was under the guidance of Professor Peirce, and the subject was parasitology. Well, parasitology, in my opinion, is one of the most complex fields of biology, with all of the strange and unusual life cycles of the many parasitic forms. It was all new to me, and even the concept of parasitology as such was new, so that I struggled, and I received an assignment on a subject in parasitology, and I struggled with that and did not do well. In fact, when it came time for me to make a presentation before the seminar group, I stumbled and waffled terribly, and I left the meeting just terribly depressed. And the next day, I went in to see Dr. Peirce, and a remarkable thing happened. In fact, it was one of the important steps as an influence in my life. I explained to Dr. Pearce that I simply didn't have the background for the work that I was attempting to do. And he listened carefully, and after a period, well, I didn't know quite what to expect. Some way or another, having more training before undertaking as much as I had undertaken thus far. So he asked one or two questions. First, he wanted to know how I was getting along with the students, and I replied that I hadn't been cornered by anybody yet, but it might happen any day. He spoke up and said, "Maybe there's hope for you." He said, "You don't know very much about this, but you seem to realize it." He said, "So many of the graduate students we get in here don't know very much, and they don't realize it." Well, that remark, those remarks, such as they were a shot in the arm for me, and life took off with a great renewal. When came time for the second semester, the seminar topic was quite different, and I volunteered very early for one of the subjects, which was the evolution of placentation, the different placentas that show in the different species. I was fascinated with the embryology anyhow, and on the subject of placentation, the feeding of the young from the mother and so on, was a very stimulating subject. And I worked out a set of drawings on brown wrapping paper that spread all the way around the four sides of the seminar room. And when it came time for me to give the presentation, that one I felt came off exceptionally well. By this time, I was deeply involved in with the different classes and so on, studying evolution. Evolution was in the background. I was studying cytology, and I was studying behavior and anatomy, and perhaps at this point I should explain that as that first year moved along, Dr. Geyer and I talked a bit about a subject for a thesis and for special study, and it was, as you will remember, a period when Dr. Geyer stood exceptionally high because of his work on the inheritance of acquired characters as a subject, and he was using immunology as a possible passage of antigens from the mother to the embryo as one way of influencing the young and perhaps impressing on character on the germplasm. At the time I entered, at the time I was at the University of Wisconsin, this was still an open field. The question was still open. It wasn't long, however, until it closed, showing that the approach was not a valid one. However, I had commenced to work on the possibility that damaged skin from sunburns and other kinds of injury might produce antibodies that would affect mother or the embryo. And in fact, my very first paper was published on this subject. Dr. Geyer, to characterize him just a bit, was a quiet man. He managed his department effectively without show. He operated with his graduate students in a quiet manner, pretty much letting them follow their own course. I had heard him speak of his policy, which was to create the opportunity for graduate students to develop and express themselves, and then let happen what will. This was quite different from the way Dr. Hyslop at that stage, one of the prominent faculty members, operated. Dr. Hyslop worked very closely with his students, and I couldn't help but feel the impact of that approach. But I never really felt a strong desire to have it different from the way Dr. Geyer was managing things. As things developed, I arranged for a minor in the medical sciences, anatomy, chemistry, physiology, histology, and with a fellow graduate student, Harold Beams, one who came from Kansas near where I was, and who became a very close personal friend, and I entered the department of the class of anatomy in the medical school. We started at the middle of the year along with some physical education students, and women physical education students. Dr. Bardeen at that time, who was dean of the medical school, had this class. To give one interesting incident, he would call roll. He was a phlegmatic type, spoke with a kind of monotone, but very sharp. He was calling the roll one day, or at the beginning, came to one particular name. He said, "Mildred Outhouse." She said, "Present." And without lifting his eyes, changing his voice or anything, Dr. Bardeen says, "Some guy will sure do you a favor when he marries you." Well, it was somewhat typical of Dr. Bardeen. He had many interesting things that he did with students. But dissecting a human body for me was profound. I had a respect for the body just because it was human. But when I began to see how nature had organized so carefully and so specifically, so that I could use a text that had been written in some far-off place and look and find precisely these different anastomoses of nerves, blood vessels, and the arrangement of foramen, where the vessels would enter and leave bones and so on. It was humbling and inspiring. It is a 12-credit course, and Beams and I worked together for a whole year. And to understand anatomy, one has to know embryology rather well too, so that the net result of that work in a medical school was remarkable indeed. When we combined that with physiological chemistry and histology, I developed a profound respect for the science of medicine. In zoology, I was taking cytology and attempting to do some research. Among other things, I became interested in tissue culture. And tissue culture is a remarkable technique. It requires aseptic handling continuously. It was necessary to draw off blood I used the blood of rabbits under aseptic conditions, centrifuge it again aseptically to get rid of the red corpuscles and get plasma, cool this before it would coagulate, and then the tissue that we attempted to grow was a chick embryo heart, and we incubate the eggs up to a certain point, and then remove the fragment of heart again aseptically and plant it onto a slide with a drop of plasma which would clot if everything was handled properly. This then was incubated, and we didn't have equipment. I had to build some equipment, but nevertheless maintained a temperature. But there were many failures, and I remember, though, very distinctly, one cold night along about 11 o'clock, it was about 20 below outside, and as typical of the graduate students, we were working late, and I thought, well, before I go, I'll go and look at this particular specimen, and I put it under the microscope, and lo and behold, there it was. That chick embryo heart was beating. And as I sat there and watched this rhythmic beat, the chills just ran up and down my back. And it was a moment of exaltation that I've never forgotten. This was profound also. And soon I put it away and took off over the hill for the dormitory, and not even noticing the cold night as it was. Professor Wagner was, for me, every inch a scholar and professor. He had a manner and a decorum that was formal without being stiff. He was approachable. You could talk with him, but conversations usually were lofty and on significant subjects. He had a beautiful manner in front of classes and had one unique characteristic which he exploited. He was good with drawings, and he would use both hands, and when he had a bilaterally symmetrical figure to draw, he could make the two sides show up with the two hands operating at the same time, and this fascinated students. To characterize Dr. Pierce a little bit more, one of the jobs that the graduate student has, or had at that time, was operating the lantern. Dr. Pierce had traveled in different parts of the world and collected a lot of pictures showing people in Africa and other places who had been infected with different kinds of parasites. And he had a picture, well, the slides, the projector was in the back of the room, and he had a little button right beside the lectern where he would lecture, and when he would press that, it would cause a little light right beside the projector in the back of the room to go on, and that meant that he was ready for the next slide. Well, I had the task of being the operator, the slide operator, for one of his parasitology classes. And on this particular occasion, he had a slide that was a slide that showed an African who had developed, I think it was elephantiasis, which caused enormous swelling of the scrotum. And it was a nude picture of a man sitting on a stump and this scrotum hanging almost like a watermelon between the legs toward the ground. And to make this slide acceptable and decent for showing to a mixed class of young students at that time, Dr. Pierce had taken a piece of gummed label and pasted it on the slide to cover this large scrotum. Well, when the slide went into the lantern, the heat dried that label, and it curled off just like a curtain rolling down, as though it had been carefully planned and intricately developed to cause this to happen. The class sort of snickered. Dr. Peirce looked up to see what was happening, and the little light beside the lantern began to flash, 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 and I got on to the next slide very rapidly. I suppose this sort of thing wouldn't bother classes in these days, and probably the label would not even have been put on the slide. Physiology, as taught in a medical school, was a marvelous course. It was under Dr. Meek, and Dr. Meek was a mild-mannered, efficient lecturer, and this was an inspiring course for me. Biochemistry under Dr. Bradley was a very nice course. I had some difficulty with chemistry. My preparation for that had not been sufficient, so that I had to work pretty hard on it, but it was a revealing course also. One of the stories told about Dr. Bradley was that the way he came down to the laboratory one Sunday afternoon, he lived out along the lake and it was frozen over, and he had seven sons, as I remember it, and this particular occasion he had them all on skates and he was leading them out across the lake, and it made quite a scene, one that was described in various ways. Some others of the faculty, there was among others Dr. William Marshall in entomology. I had only slight contact with Dr. Marshall, but had great respect for him. He was like Dr. Wagner, a man who was somewhat more formal but easy to talk with. Dr. Noland was one of the younger faculty members, and in dealing with protozoology, he taught courses that were interesting. He was quite young at the time. Later, he became a very much beloved leader in the department. Dr. Jude in limnology, I had only slight contact with him, but it was interesting to me at that stage to see Dr. Burge, who was president of the university before Glenn Frank. Dr. Burge had come from biology, and he and Dr. Jude had fostered work in lake studies. And, of course, the University of Wisconsin was so uniquely located for this kind of thing because of the five beautiful lakes around the university. But at the stage that I was there, Dr. Burge, who then was elderly and somewhat feeble, would come to the laboratory almost daily. And I remember the feelings that I used to have concerning that. Some way or another, I had pictured people who had held high administrative position as in categories above and beyond where I was, but to see him come back to the laboratory after having been president and struggle to write more scientific papers impressed me profoundly. I thought that was remarkable. It helped set sights for me. Dr. Herrick at that time was a new person, a good teacher, but a more ordinary kind of individual, I would tend to say. As I got into my second year of graduate work, I was ready for examination as a candidate for a master's degree. The examination was oral, and I managed to get through reasonably well. I didn't have a remarkable feeling about it, but at least I was on top at that stage and making headway, but it was still pretty rough going. Getting on into the next year, I came up for the preliminary examinations as a candidate for the PhD. And by that time, I had gotten on top of things rather well and knew the way around pretty well, knew the kinds of questions that were asked and the kinds of theories and concepts that questions would lead to. So when I entered into this examination for the PhD, I was able to anticipate and to answer in advance, and it came off pretty rapidly and with no embarrassing moments. And in fact, I had a very good feeling about that development. I felt that I was meeting the standards that had been laid down and was being successful. In 1929, I had completed the coursework requirements that had been laid down for my work as a PhD candidate, and that left a research project to be done the next year. I'd like to point out that year 1928 and 1929, in working with Dr. Geyer, I got to doing cancer transplantation, and he had been successful. In one of his visits to New York State, he came in contact with William Coolidge of the General Electric Company, and Dr. Coolidge made available to him a cathode ray generator. And this Dr. Geyer brought back to the campus and had installed in the Department of Physical Chemistry, in the chemistry department, where Dr. Farrington Daniels was chairman. And Dr. Geyer had the interesting idea. He said, since X-rays are generated when electrons moving through the X-ray tube strike a metal surface, why not use colloidal particles and inject them directly into the tumor and then then direct a beam of electrons into the tumor, with the idea that there would be a more effective treatment of the tumor with radiation. Well, I was designated to handle the animals, prepare the tumors, inject them with colloidal platinum, and handle them in front of the cathode ray tube. A student by the name of Marshall Finley, Alexander Finley, I believe it was, in the chemistry department, was designated to operate the equipment. There'll be more to say about Finley in connection with the dormitory a little later. But in any case, one of the things that happened was that I would prepare the animals, and then it was somewhat uncertain as to whether the cathode ray equipment would operate. On one occasion, I had animals prepared, all injected with tumors and all injected with the colloidal platinum, and the tube failed. Well, I kept the animals, and amazingly enough, the tumors disappeared, which was mysterious. But to make the story short, we discovered that one of the responses to the colloidal platinum was an encapsulation which would strangle the tumors and cause them to shut off. Well, we were saved by not getting mixed up with the radiation in that case, but Dr. Geyer got a paper out of it, and it was an interesting achievement in itself. In 1928, Harold Beams and I, some way or another, managed to go to the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science meetings, in New York City. At that time, I saw for the first time motion pictures of tissue culture growth, that is, speeded up growth. And to see cell division on the screen actually was an amazing experience for me. It was just stimulating as it could possibly be. Among other things, at that meeting, I met a young lady who later became my wife. She at that time was in the Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C. We were attracted to each other, exchanged some letters later, and although I was much struck by her, I could not see that any possibility that things would work out for us, mainly because of distance. Well, she had something to do about this. That summer, as was customary for young biologists, I arranged to go to Woods Hole Woods Hole, Massachusetts, on Cape Cod, at the Marine Biological Station there, and to take a class in physiology. And Christine arranged to be there to take a course in botany. Well, that made things happen. And we enjoyed the summer. I was due to go back to the University of Wisconsin for the year 1930, but as it happened, in the mess hall, I was seated by a young man, Ware Cattell, who was employed in New York City and working on cancer. In our conversation, he explained this to me, and I said, "Gee whiz, you lucky fellow. I'd give a left arm to be able to have a job like that." Well, it just so happened that his chief was out there at Woods Hole looking for a young physiologist, and this feeling was transmitted to him, and soon I was offered a chance to go there, and I explained that I had not completed the work at the University of Wisconsin. The question was, "Have you completed your coursework?" And the answer was yes. So the proposition was, "Why don't you come to the Memorial Hospital in New York and do a thesis study there as a part of your work and present it at the University of Wisconsin?" It was irregular, but I presented the idea to Dr. Geyer by writing, and in time this worked out, and in time I went to New York, and Christine and I, and I started work the 1st of October, that is October 1929. As can be remembered, it was later that month that the stock market crashed, and things began to happen around me because of that. Not nearly as seriously, however, as for others. In my particular case, there was a bit of a reduction in pay, about 15%, but the salary held and the job held. During that first year on that job, I accepted, developed the problem for study of the effects of alpha particles on Drosophila egg development. And this was to be my thesis material. Well, as the way things worked out, alpha particles are emitted by radon. And radon is a gas that's given off by radium. And at the hospital, we had, I think it was about a gram of radium, and the radon gas was collected into capillary glass tubes, which are cut to a length of about an inch or so. And these were implanted directly into tumors for therapeutic purposes. Well, in time, these accumulated, and so the procedure for getting alpha particles was to take these tubes, crack them up, grind them, and extract them with acid, and plate the material out on a copper disc, and the alpha particles then would be given off from this disc. They penetrate only a very short distance into matter, but I then subjected the Drosophila eggs to the influence of these particles. The work started off rather nicely. But as fate would have it, within a month or so after the work started, the culture of Drosophila that I had simply refused to lay eggs. I struggled and struggled vainly to get collections of eggs enough to work with in the study that I was carrying out. Well, I got some work done, and according to the plan, this was to be put into a thesis and subjected to the University of Wisconsin, Dr. Geyer and his department. I think it was about the 1st of March. Well, came the 1st of March, and I didn't have nearly all of the material that I had wanted to have, but I wrote up what I had and sent it in for evaluation. The results were negative, and quite a number of suggestions were made of things that should be done before considering the work acceptable. Strangely also, while the material had been sent to the university for examination, I managed to get the cultures to laying eggs again, and I had to by the time this rejection came with its suggestions of things to do, actually had done nearly all of them. And so I ask for the special privilege then of rewriting the thesis and sending it with, there wasn't time for review then, but coming to the University of Wisconsin and defending it. With some reluctance, this was permitted. And I went to Wisconsin and responded to questions about the work And with some reluctance, it seemed to me there was reluctance, they granted, they passed me, and that gave me my degree. I came away from that experience, however, without a good feeling. I felt that I had not done well, and that much more should have been done. However, there were two points of great good fortune. This gave me a professional standing to work with, and as it happened, the job that I had in New York stood, and the depression didn't hurt me too terribly. I was married then to Christine in the fall of 1930, and she joined the staff at Memorial Hospital, and we worked together for a couple of years when she then accepted the responsibility of developing our family. Before talking briefly about my professional work, let me now go back to my experiences on the campus at the University of Wisconsin at the dormitories, Tripp and Adams Hall. A question posed, had you lived in a residence hall before becoming a house fellow? Answer is no. Another question, when and why did you decide to become a house fellow? In 1926, I think it was, I learned, that is during the spring of that year, I learned of the possibility of the dormitory fellow opportunity, and as I remember it, made out a written application, which was brief, which was submitted. The question, how were house fellows chosen and by whom? I do not have very much information on this. I remember that Don Halverson was the person in charge of dormitories at the time, and he had had a strong administrative role. I'm sure he was involved in the selections, but what other people were involved, I have no idea. The question, how did you learn you were chosen? As I remembered, it was a written notice. Were all house fellows graduate students? No, they were not. Some were young faculty members. Describe the orientation program for new house fellows. There was essentially none, and this really surprised me. I kept expecting that we would be instructed into what our duties would be, but as the time approached for the first occupants in 1926, there was a meeting called of dormitory fellows, and we met across the lake, across Lake Mendota, one afternoon in the open, a picnic supper, and Dean Slichter, graduate dean at the time, gave some thoughts about the dormitory situation, and there was very little said about what the dormitory fellows' responsibilities would be, as I remembered. And I remember asking others about this as we left there. Dean Slichter, among other things, talked about a new kind of student, saying that in addition to those who wanted to be scholars, there were those who wanted a university degree and the experience of the campus for a period of 4 years and have their status increased in the community because of that. I remember being a little shocked by this, inasmuch as it was pulling away from the conventional idea of scholarship to one of, well, of prestige and standing. But we entered the work, we arrived on the scene in the dormitories, moved in, the students moved in at the same time. The walks weren't completed yet. There was a fair amount of mud around, and some of the students got into this a bit, but not in a disagreeable fashion to any extent. Were the philosophy and traditions of the House Fellow System discussed, and what were they? I don't know that I have anything more to say on that. We entered into this work as persons available to the students. They could come to us if there were problems, and we would transmit, either handle them or transmit them. Really, there weren't too many problems. A bit of a water fight once or twice, but things settled down, and the students performed in quite a nice way. The questionnaire under point two on the job, when you began, what did you perceive as being your major responsibilities? Well, from the things I've said already, other than just being available and being somewhat of a guide by action, or a model by my action, I didn't have much of an idea. Next question, did you conduct an orientation session for the residents? The answer is no. What rules and expectations did you communicate to the residents? Well, I don't know that we communicated anything except an example of being a dignified student in a university of standing. How often and for what reasons did residents seek you out? Not very often at all, only occasionally. I will here give an example, however. On the fourth floor, there were several of Seebecker House, where I was at first. There was a young German professor and a freshman. This young freshman was a sort of rough-hewn fellow, and he had commenced to develop the habit of getting up about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and studying then, and he'd push his chairs around on the terrazzo floor and they'd screech and disturb the people up and down the corridor. More than this, he would get into the shower and take a cold shower and grunt and make noises that disturbed people. And so the first thing I discovered was that some people are moving away from the fourth floor, and so I admonished them and asked them to hold until I could investigate a bit. And I brought the young man down. His name was Byron Olson. And Byron, I said, what gives? What's the problem? Don't you understand that you're disturbing these people? And, well, there was another, yes, let me mention another complaint of Byron. He would come in with muddy feet and put his feet up on other people's beds when he was talking. And in connection with this, I said, Byron, why do you do these things? And, well, he said, what's wrong with it? And I said, well, haven't you been able to notice that the other people don't like it? And he said, yes. And I said, well, usually these are sufficient indications to most people so that they begin to get in line and perform better. That is, if they're interested in cooperation. Well, the upshot of it was that we moved Byron instead of having the others move. And Byron settled down, he took off, and there were no more problems of this sort. And interestingly, 25 years later, in Washington, D.C., where I had a very nice office and job, a man came in one day dressed in a beautiful Public Health Service uniform, and here was Byron. He said, "Do you remember me?" And after a while, I got him spotted, and we exchanged words a bit, and he was gone. But I think, if I can interpret things, Byron wanted me to see that he had gotten past that rough period and had made it. Well, anyhow, that was the interpretation I placed on his action, and I got satisfaction from the fact that he had come. Generally, I think it is proper to say that discipline was not a problem. Another question, did the residents in your charge ever sponsor any social events, sports contests, or other group projects? Yes, there were some dances, very nice dances, held in the refectory, and but the sports events and things of this sort were not sponsored by the dormitory. There were other locations on campus for them. Were people outside your residence hall, outside your residence hall, that is faculty, administration, members of the housing staff, ever involved? Back to Al Finley now. Al Finley, the man that I was associated with in the cancer research, and the man who was responsible to Farrington Daniels and had operated the cathode ray tube in the chemistry department, borrowed some alcohol from the laboratory and got a little bit inebriated one evening, and his house fellow found him and admonished him. In fact, required him to go back to the chemistry department and report that he had taken alcohol away from the laboratory. This meant that young Findlay had to go to Farrington Daniels, a man that he respected just beyond words to describe, and to have to go to him, which he did, and admit that he had done something wrong, was perhaps as great a punishment as could have been given to this young man. The Dean of Men, however, Dean Sellers, if I remember correctly, insisted, though, that some retribution would have to be taken by the dormitory. The dormitory said, fellows group then took the attitude that this was a campus matter and it should be handled by the Dean of Men. And the thing began to jostle back and forth in such a way that Finley, who had been trite and wanted to put things right and had admitted that he was wrong, then began to be disgusted with the disciplinary action that was being taken. And the case, I'm not sure how it ever came out. I think it just kind of disappeared. But that was one that did not come out too well, simply because of awkward management and cooperation between the dormitory fellows and the Dean of Men's office. But there were very few of these kinds of things, almost none. The life in the dormitories, and the dormitories was pretty smooth running. This doesn't mean that it was dull, nor necessarily sedate. There were common rooms in each dormitory unit, and there was lots of music and many lively discussions that took place in those places. And the rooms were used for study, and study was a serious matter. Describe a typical day as a House Fellow. That's under point three, a typical day. Detail the evening meal. Well, the days were pretty ordinary. I went to classes, went to the office early in the morning, that is 8, 9 o'clock. Often went back to the laboratory in the evening. The refectory operated for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. The dormitory fellows sat at the end of the table, and the boys were around. Usually from one house there'd be two tables of fellows. This was a period of animated discussion. It was a lively period. The table manners were what you'd expect of animated, well-motivated young men. There was lots of joking and carrying on, but no throwing of food. And the day was casual, and the manner was sedate, and a good tone, at least as I would evaluate it. Point four, staff. Who was your supervisor? Characterize him. How often did you and your supervisor meet, and for what purpose? Characterize other members of the housing staff. Did you ever meet with other house fellows professionally, socially? Discuss members of the residence hall staff, cooks, and so forth. To a supervisor, there essentially wasn't one. George Chandler performed the role of being somewhat of a coordinator, and occasionally the fellows did meet and discuss some of the problems, but there weren't very many problems. And most of the things that came up are things that could be handled between the dormitory fellow and the students. But for the most part, it was good living, and without very many problems. I haven't any idea, but I can't help but wonder if Dean Schlichter and the others who set up this system didn't anticipate that this was really the best way to have things happen. Just deal with problems as they come, and not try to anticipate and set up too many rules in advance. Okay, now number five, miscellany. Compare UW's residence halls at the time you were a house fellow with those of other colleges you were familiar with. I had no other experiences, so I have nothing to say here. Compare UW's residence halls at the time you were a house fellow with UW's Greek houses, the YMCA, co-ops, and off-campus rooming houses. Compared with the Greek houses, my impression was that the boys who lived in the dormitories didn't feel that they were missing too much, that there was some, but they really didn't get too excited because they weren't in the Greek houses. With respect to the YMCA, the co-ops, and off-campus rooming houses, there was, the opportunity for broader fraternization and group dances and things of that sort that the people in these other organizations didn't have. The life in the dormitory at the time I was there was thought of as rather special and regarded as such. Were you aware of or did you ever witness racial or religious discrimination in residence halls? The answer is no, I did not at any time. A kind of remarkable situation, perhaps. There were very few Negroes. In fact, it was almost pure white. As a house fellow, did you ever have any encounters with the dean of men or the dean of women? Not other than the one that I described above. If you were a house fellow in the 1930s, what impact did the Great Depression have on your residence hall? I was a dormitory fellow before the Depression, so I have no answer here. If you were a house fellow in the early to mid-1940s, what impact did World War II have on the residence hall? Same here. A house fellow in the mid to late 40s, what impact did the post-war recovery have on your residence hall? Again, this doesn't apply in my case. Now, milestones. What milestone events and enduring themes in the history of housing deserve special note? I would tend to say naturalness. There was not a great deal of fall to roll, like in the Greek houses. People came, lived, did their thing, respected others, and associated with others, and it was a high level, appropriate, and proper kind of activity. There was now number 7, the last point. Please add any comments or observations you wish about matters not mentioned above. From my own personal standpoint, my life in the dormitories was a lifesaver. It did two things that were noteworthy in my case. First, it provided my housing and food, which and I was having difficulty financially in my situation, and this made it possible for me to continue my graduate work through until I got a job. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, the position that I was in, the standards that were set, the associations that occurred, gave me a standing in my own mind of much greater esteem. I became somebody. I was important. I was things were working out for me, and being a dormitory fellow aided in this way very especially. Now let me go back to the general questionnaire. I've made comments already about the Department of Zoology and the medical school. Those are points 2 and 3. Under 3, reference to facilities, I can only give a general attitude about this. In my own view, I felt that the classrooms were adequate, significant, and well managed, as you would expect in a university. I should point out that the period during which I was at the University of Wisconsin was before the period of grants, and the pressures were not nearly so great. The administration, both in the Department of Zoology and the School of Medicine, as I sensed it, was low pressure, casual, fair, and efficient. There was not the pressure to publish or get grants, although publishing was encouraged and so on. The laboratories were adequate, library facilities, both in the main library and in the departmental libraries, There was much to work with. It was rich. Point four, the student life. Dormitories I've already discussed. Outside activities, did you attend social, cultural, political, or athletic events on campus or within the Madison community? Describe them in as much detail as possible. Did you otherwise use the union? Did you make use of the student health service? How else did you make contact with graduate students from outside your field? In my case, I was so completely consumed with the graduate work that was almost my life. There was not much social or no political or athletic operations or events or participation. I used the Memorial Union for lunches now and then, and for a few meetings, and that was all. Did you make use of the student health service? Essentially none, because I didn't have problems. How else did you make contact with graduate students from outside your field of study? Through lunches and seminars and so on. Number five, all university. Campus leadership and personalities. Discuss important indicative incidents and themes associated with the presidency of Glenn Frank. Similarly, discuss LNS Dean Celery, Graduate Dean Charles Slichter, past President Burge, and other prominent campus figures. These men all stood out as significant in my mind, but in categories apart from mine. We didn't touch or have contact, and aside from respect and leaving alone, that was pretty much it. The Experimental College, which was in Adams Hall, under Professor Micklejohn, if I remember, I had very little contact with it, but tended to feel that some innovative ideas were being tested. University Library, describe the facilities available to you and the use you made of them. How did Wisconsin's library compare with other libraries which you were familiar with at the time? Well, the library facilities, as I've already indicated, I felt were superior. They were great. And in times since, I've been in many libraries on different campuses, and the libraries in Washington, New York, and so on, and the one in Wisconsin ranks well with the others, in my opinion. Now, the subject of women and minorities. As I've indicated, at the dormitory, and this, what I've said, applies pretty much elsewhere, because there were very few other than Caucasian people, and minority problems were not problems of any consequence during the period that I was there, as I saw the situation. With respect to women, in the Department of Zoology, men and women worked together on an equal, and views were different then. The women were not under pressure to compete with men and show that they could do everything that men do. And there was the nuclear family was still a matter of respect, and women had their role and men had their role. And they were different. Professionally, there was equality, it seemed to me. Although more often, men would become heads of departments than women. That was not because of discrimination. It was because of the character of the work and the roles of the respective sexes. How would these points of view compare to perspectives associated with the women's movement of recent years. I would say there's quite a contrast. The pressure for women to express themselves professionally and in business is very great. The need to become effective was there before, but the pressures were not the same. People lived more naturally in accord with their situations and as things existed at the time. When possible, make comparison with other universities with which you were familiar. How many students from outside Wisconsin perceived and treated? I have no comments here. Milestones and comparisons. What milestone event, themes in the history of University of Wisconsin, perhaps the general history of American higher education, deserves special note in this study? Compare the University of Wisconsin with institutions you have observed elsewhere. I can say only that, in my view, the University of Wisconsin stands extremely well in comparison with educational institutions generally. There are institutions like Harvard, Columbia, University of California that have certain distinctive aspects to them, but Wisconsin as a general university of very high caliber stands out to me as noteworthy. Now, number six, other comments. At this point, let me give a very quick thumbnail of things that I've been associated with and things I've done since leaving Wisconsin. And I think in almost every case, it'll be evident the influence that the experiences at the university had. As I left to Wisconsin, as indicated already, I went to the Memorial Hospital for the treatment of cancer and allied diseases in New York City. That is, as a research person, the research theme was a search for the effects of high energy radiations on living systems, and in particular, to search for the explanation of how high energy radiation on the one hand will produce cancer and then on the other can be used for the treatment of it. I worked at the Memorial Hospital for 9 years, then went to the National Cancer Institute as it opened in the fall of 1939. And the research topics were the same. Various papers were written. Very soon World War II came on and I was drawn into the Atomic Energy Project, Manhattan District Project, went to the University of Chicago for a 3 month period, and then to Oak Ridge where I and my staff put through some 35,000 rats and mice, exposing them to the different radiations from the new piles, reactors that were being developed. We saw cancer in just large numbers. This prepared me, and I was selected to be a member of the First Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission to Japan to observe the effects on the Japanese. This was in the fall of 1946. About 16 months after the bombs had been dropped. And our activities there led to the establishment of the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission that operated until just recently. I got invited then to be a part of the of MacArthur's organization, what they called the Supreme Command Allied Powers, and was a part of the scientific and technical division and I had the august title of being chairman of the fundamental research unit or department, and our task was to assist the Japanese in rehabilitation of their scientific organizations. This was a profound experience, and by the time I came back to the United States, I felt it important to move beyond cancer to other things. So many people of the world were placing such dependence on the United States, and so few in the United States really appreciated this. I got into international health and assisted in promoting health programs in various parts of the world, and this immediately ran into the population question, and this led me to leave government, and I became director of research for the Planned Parenthood Federation. I think I can boast and make it to stick that I have the first scientific paper on the pill that was published. This led on to work again in the Atomic Energy Commission, where I was concerned with the funding work, and for 10 years was concerned with the managing and promotion of the projects for grants proposals that had been made to the commission. At that time, the interest arose in the effects of radiation on the nervous system, and since we didn't have other people available to who had experience, I was designated to handle those projects that dealt with this subject. And this led to an inquiry into the effects of radiation on nervous system function of youngsters irradiated in utero. I went to Philadelphia, where there were examples, cases of this sort. What I saw was an activity devoted to the rehabilitation of brain-injured children. And this opened the way for my concern and interest in the field of cybernetics, and I have recently been involved, well, I became involved with the establishment of the new Society of Cybernetics, and have recently prepared a book which puts together much of what can be said in terms of systems control and management by means of information, treating information as an influence and a kind of force with the dynamics of its own. I am just now completing a book under the title of InfoPower, and it traces how information processing is done in systems all the way from molecules to cells, organisms, and social systems. I have enjoyed good health and continue to be active. I am fortunate in this respect, and now I think I will terminate, but by saying to you, John Jenkins, that if what I put together here is not satisfactory for your purposes, I'd be glad to have you consult me and see if we can't come closer to what you have in mind. This has been a review. It's a little ragged. If I were to write it, I could make it much more precise, but speaking it, it comes out as it has come out, and perhaps you can find in it elements of the kind that, as a historian, you're looking for. In any case, please feel free to consult me if you wish. With this, I will sign off, wishing you everything that is good. Bye-bye.